Welcome to the Future of Pharma with ISP Boston, where I talk to the thought leaders of the pharmaceutical industry about where our industry is headed and what you can do about it. I'm your host, Samir Gondalia. Thanks for joining us today.
My guest today is Professor Bernard Trout of MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's a professor with the Chemical Engineering Department. He did his bachelor's and master's at MIT. Then he did his PhD at University of California, Berkeley. Then he came back to MIT to teach, maybe because he got bored with 75 and sunny weather of California. The New Englanders are very eccentric when it comes to what we consider nice weather. He has been honored with numerous awards. He's regular on the Medicine Makers Power List. It's kind of the Forbes Power List with less money and more education. And he has been awarded numerous awards in speaking, research, and collaboration. Welcome to the Future of Pharma, Professor Trout.
Thank you.
As a chemical engineer, what made you interested in the pharma industry?
Well, I came to MIT, as I mentioned, about 20 years ago. I was actually not always in the pharma industry. As a matter of fact, my PhD was more in heterogeneous catalysis with environmental applications. And that was part of my initial research here. But I was always interested in more biological problems and in particular applied problems. And this opportunity to do work on formulation or molecular engineering of molecules for formulation and design of algorithms to predict formulation issues, developability issues, was too good to pass up. So I started doing that here.
Right. So one of my colleagues always used to say that the reason he joined the pharmaceutical industry is that he liked the idea of working to save lives rather than working for a petroleum company. So did that play a part in when you chose the career, or was it just the excitement of the scientific opportunities that drew you?
Well, I think that's an important part. Being in the health field broadly is extremely important. But also, I think realistically, being in energy also saves lives. You need energy to do things. You need energy to run all the great equipment that we have in healthcare. So certainly that was part of it, to be directly involved. But it was, I think, even more so a challenge and an opportunity to make impact.
Now, this is the topic everybody would want me to discuss with you, continuous manufacturing. So a few years back, and when I say a few years back, I'm talking early this decade, when continuous manufacturing, there were lots of skeptics, like validation is going to be difficult. With FDA, it's going to be very, very difficult. If you have troubleshooting, you have to change the whole documentation and so on and so forth. So first, I want to talk to you about the continuous manufacturing past, as in, can you walk us through how the idea evolved and how crazy the pioneers were considered when they proposed the idea of continuous manufacturing back in the days?
Sure. Well, I'm not sure historically what the historians of science would think is the first proposal of continuous in pharma.
Right.
I mean, in a certain sense, continuous manufacturing pharma has been around for a while. Perfusion technologies, for example, various separation technologies, even when I was an undergraduate, were around, but not implemented to a great degree. I think a major push is actually the FDA. So the FDA, I think that was a major incentive, let's say, because the Office of Quality was set up at the FDA, early this century. Mm-hmm. And continuous manufacturing, if you think about it, is really the ultimate in quality. It's high quality processing, very low risk of process failure, reduction in risk of stockouts, or able to manage a supply chain much, much better.
Right.
So if you think of it that way, continuous is really the ultimate of quality. And so that's part of it. In terms of the Novartis MIT Center for Continuous Manufacturing,
which you're heading right now,
which I'm heading, and we're still going and strong, but not as big, because we've I think completed the major part of our mission, and so that the origin of that is really the first CEO of Novartis, Daniel Vasella, was touring the different facilities with the head of technical operations, Tom Van Laar, and said, "Why do we have all these huge hallways and forklifts running through and vessels going here and there. Why isn't this more streamlined?
Oh, that's
and so
interesting.
That was the incentive for the Novartis MIT Center.
Oh, okay. So it came from the industry and the idea was brought up at this research center and then you and your team developed it.
Well, yeah, and I should say, I mean, me and my team, but broadly including certainly the Novartis colleagues
right,
who were very much a part of it.
Right,
yes.
Right. So what I'm trying to say is usually when there is a new idea, for the most part, when it's a brand new idea, for the most part, it travels from the academia to the industry. But in this case, it came from industry to academia. I'm sure there was lots of research going on in academia at that time. But that's very, very interesting. Where does the continuous manufacturing stand as of now? Like how many companies have actually implemented or in the process of implementing or how close to they are actually implementing continuous manufacturing?
Yeah, so if you permit me just a little bit of the recent history. So we started having meetings. So part of the Novartis MIT Center was direct contact with the FDA. And the FDA, we had regular meetings with them. And the FDA said, well, why don't we get other companies involved? So slowly we started getting more companies involved, more on a high level, not on a research level. And that led to our first international symposium on continuous manufacturing of pharmaceuticals in 2014. And to get to the answer now, so between 2014 and now, so this is going to be our third one coming up in October, there have now four processes they've been approved. They're partial processes. They're not full end-to-end, but they're all for small molecules.
Still, it's a few steps in the right direction to be fully a continuous manufacturer.
Several steps.
Right.
And I think the other important thing is that now continuous manufacturing, I mean, you're here, we're discussing it.
Right.
Someone's listening to it.
Yeah.
And many people, we hope, are listening to it. And so I think all companies, certainly from small to large, have continuous manufacturing on the radar screen, and probably most medium to large companies have a program to do continuous manufacturing.
Right. That is so true. 10 years ago, if you went to any pharma conference, single-use technology was everything. Everybody had a presentation. Everybody had a booth and they were either buying or selling or doing something with a single-use technology. Today, in 2018, if you go to any pharma conference, there is a separate section for continuous manufacturing, and that section is the first one to get booked. As we were talking about earlier before we started the interview, my first interaction with the continuous manufacturing was when I saw your presentation during MIT R&D conference, which is held in February. And at that time, you had that video clip of your pilot facility where you have chemicals and all the ingredients on one side and other side you get the tablet. And it was less than 5 years ago and it looks so futuristic, and now it's becoming it's on the path to becoming a reality. Now if resources and technology were not a hindrance, you can have any technology you want and money is not a problem, what would your ideal continuous manufacturing plant look like?
Well, okay, so you've released a lot of constraints for me.
Yes,
Samir, so thank you. let's just analyze the question a little bit. Sort of resources in money is one thing. I think the industry as a whole agrees that continuous processes are much more efficient, lower chance of process problems, higher quality in that regard, but also cost savings.
Right, yeah. Inventory and I'm sure all
inventory,
the
inventory, exactly. Very important part of it. So yeah. All kinds of supply chain issues.
Right.
So in a certain sense, that's not the resource that's the issue. The resource that's the main issue is, you know, you guys in your companies are all busy. Everyone's busy on their products. In academics, we have a little more leisure. We don't have quarterly reports and
right.
profits and whatnot. We don't have targets for investors, although we do in a sense in our research because those who sponsor us are investing
yeah.
us. But having said
they
that,
they have to answer to their investors.
And they have to answer there. But we can develop technology. In a company, you're running projects where you have to get products out the door. But to implement continuous manufacturing, you have to change the way you do things. And so that is what I might call an entropic barrier, but it has real costs in terms of resources, because your most valuable resource is your people.
Right.
So that would be the constraint that I would remove. And once that constraint is removed, I think the technologies, we can always do better. We can have better sensor technologies, better control technologies and whatnot. But I think if we could remove that particular resource constraint, then the industry as a whole would be able to adopt these technologies and we would have end-to-end integrated processes across the board and they'd save money.
And do you see awareness in the industry and the senior leadership who make decisions on this kind of resources that yes, they are talking about it, they are aware of it, and they are making decisions to remove the constraint to move in this direction? Or do we still see a lot of resistance? Or
yes, understood. I think it varies, of course, and that's something that's exciting, that it varies across companies and how they're addressing continuous manufacturing. Like I said, pretty much every company has some sort of investment in the area.
Right.
So senior management are, but they vary from, you know, gung-ho, we're going to make this happen, to cautiously investing in it. It's understood there's a diversity of different approaches, and the diversity of approaches is manifest in the challenge that I just mentioned of trying to get continuous manufacturing processes developed for the company while still getting your products out the door in the same amount of time.
Right. Now, your work that I saw, the presentation I saw, was for small molecule APIs. What lessons can we implement from the small molecule continuous manufacturing that we can implement to biologics continuous manufacturing? Because biologics is, you know, totally different process and they're totally different quality challenges. But I'm sure there are certain things at first principle level that we can learn from here and implement to biologic.
Yes, absolutely. And on a high level, the overall approach is the same. So the overall approach is integration of the processes, systems development, and systems engineering for the process as a whole,
okay.
Accurate analytics, together with model-based control.
It's more so for biologics, analytics, that's so sensitive, so that's good to know.
It's more so. I mean, the challenge is biologics are more complicated systems, so the analytics are more challenging.
And it takes a while to get the result back. That's one of the bottlenecks, from what I understand, for continuous manufacturing biologics. So you're absolutely right that for biologics, if you're running an assay, it might take you 2 days, 3 days, 4 days to get the assay back, but the process is still going. So please go ahead. This, you said analytics, and I said,
yeah, that's right.
That's
yeah, no, that was good. That was a I could tell your face lit up with that.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. And so it's combination of analytics and process understanding to the level of detail that's needed. So 2 days for a result is probably not going to be good enough to be able to implement in a control system, of course. But let's say if you have some kind of assay which takes 2 days, and then you work and understand the particular aspects of your process and what is responsible for whatever the result of that assay is, whether it's some activity or something else. And then you have a surrogate property which directly correlates to that. That means that you have an analytical technique where you can get in a very short time the information that's needed and control your process so your final quality parameters are right on. So you asked me, this kind of was generated by the connection between small molecule and biologics.
Right.
And you're right, the specifics might differ, but the overall approach is the same. And I'll add just one more thing on that. That's why in this meeting, which I'll put another plug for in October in London, International Symposium on Continuous Manufacturing, when we started in 2014, it was a little bit of biologics, but mainly small molecules.
Mm-hmm.
2016, maybe two-thirds, one-third, and now it's 50-50, and we intend to continue that way.
Interesting. Yeah. So we're talking about analytics, and who knows? It might give the required incentive to the instrumentation and analytical groups to come up with a technology that will analyze the samples faster, if I'm just being very, very optimistic.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of technology development, but I would also make the case that we could do a lot with continuous manufacturing given existing technologies.
It's
not as perfect as it's going to be 20 years from now, but the more we do, the sooner we do, and the sooner we do it, the more advantages we'll have as early on as possible.
Now, what are your thoughts on developability and manufacturability of drugs and continuous manufacturing and the connection between those? Manufacturability.
Absolutely. Your key question, Samir. Thank you. There's music to my ears. Because the industry, if you see how it's evolved over a decade or even 5 years, these concepts weren't around really 10 years ago. Maybe they just started to be around.
Right, right.
Developability, manufacturability, these kind of concepts. And what they're doing is giving us the incentive and the understanding and the strategic approach to start early on in discovery with, is our molecule going to be developable into a product, and is it going to be manufacturable? And that's what's going to really make this industry much more effective. And as we know, as you mentioned at the very beginning, I mean, the end product is the patient.
Right, right.
And everything that we can do to help the patient starts as early on as possible. And so I think the old paradigm of just worrying about binding to some target to affect some pathway without thinking about the product as a whole and the process as a whole and the interconnection between the two, that is slowly but surely on its way out.
Right. And also the current awareness in the society about how much it's going to cost me. Like 20 years ago, if you had a cure for cancer, cost was not an issue. But now there is this awareness, you know, not necessarily political, but cost of pharmaceutical, cost of medicine has become an issue and people ask questions. So that will become more and more important that, yes, you have this medicine, it can cure this thing, but how much it's going to cost me? Will I be able to afford it? Will the society be able to afford it? So that will become very, very important when we, because if you make, you can have a great product, but if people can't buy it, then it's no good.
Right. That's a very serious problem. And cost of manufacturing, cost of goods, it can be significant.
Now, you also do work on the rare events. And when I think of rare event, I think of something which has very low probability of happening, like two airplanes crashing or,
right.
You know, like an honest politician or a two-year-old who listens to you, like that's like rare event. When I think of rare event, there's, I'm sure you have much more scientific and technical explanation. But what is your work, and does it? Am I at least in the right direction of something happening with very low probability, and then you take it from there and analyze?
You're exactly right. That's exactly the way to think about it. Although I'm not sure about the honest politician being of low probability, but that'd be another podcast.
Yeah, exactly. More people would listen to that podcast, by the way.
Anyway, we'll see. So, yes, exactly. That's exactly it. So how can we capture on a molecular level these kind of rare events? And these include things like aggregation of biological molecules, which we know is a problem that we try to address. And aggregation, for the most part, I should say, we try to address this problem. And I would say aggregation, now we don't think it's a rare event because aggregates show up in a lot of places.
Yeah, every step, like right? Yeah. So for every step for aggregation, right?
Right. Understanding in particular on the molecular level and capturing that is very difficult. There's no good direct experimental methods, and there's no good direct computational methods.
Okay.
And so we're trying to develop new algorithms that will help us to capture those on the molecular level. And when we understand it on a molecular level, we'll be able to engineer it.
Oh, okay. So does that mean that if you understand it at the computational level, then you can engineer or reverse engineer, and there won't be any aggregates, or we will be able to predict aggregates or low amount, or?
That's right. So there might be a trade-off, and in a certain sense, the methods that we've developed for, we call it spatial aggregation propensity, for example, and spatial charge map for viscosity, are surrogates, because we don't exactly know what's happening with hydrophobic-hydrophobic interactions on the one hand, or charge-charge interactions on the other. So we develop these methods that are surrogates, which then correlate with experimental data, so we validated them. But to the extent that we could understand this even better on the molecular level, that will allow us to design our products, the molecule, the environment, and the processes themselves to make those products so that we can, you know, probably we can't ever eliminate degradation,
right,
but we can make molecules more and more stable and allow them to be more and more useful.
All right, so bring them to the honest politician level. Can't eliminate, but make them very, very rare. What has been your biggest high, your most satisfactory achievement? I'm sure I don't mean to who's your favorite child, but I'm sure there is something that gives you a lot of satisfaction and you are still looking at that particular achievement very fondly.
Yeah, well, maybe this gets to your question. I would say one of the things that I've found very fulfilling, very exciting also, but very fulfilling is, so we develop these algorithms. They go into software, so various software vendors license them, incorporate them. Beovia, for example, licensed this spatial aggregation map, a propensity, spatial aggregation propensity. And
SAP.
They call it AgMap.
Right, okay.
The kind of our term, research term is SAP. Exactly right. And what's really fulfilling is when companies, because I don't know what happens, people use it confidentially. I don't even know who's using it exactly.
Right.
And what's very fulfilling is at conferences when someone comes up and says, oh, you know, I just want to let you know we've been using your algorithms. They've really been helping us. We've been developing new products. That's the something that's very exciting when someone just comes out of the blue and they've been using this and it's been helping them in their product development and design.
And I'm sure it brings back all the memories of whenever you were working on the project on that particular software years ago, a decade ago.
We try to avoid those, Samir, because when we work on research, I should say, basically everything goes wrong on a daily basis and nothing ever works. I'm sure that never happens with you. But
no, I haven't had any failure. Now, which books have you most been influenced by? It can be one, can be more. Not necessarily your favorite book, but the books that have influenced you.
Hmm. So and you're talking about scientific books or just
any
broadly?
Any book. Like a lot of people are inspired by The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho's book. It's a fiction, 100-page fiction book about a shepherd, but a lot of people find inspiration in it. I talked to someone yesterday, and he was influenced by The 7 Habits of Stephen Covey. So, different people get influenced by different things. You can find inspiration in a bumper sticker.
okay, you're going to be very good if you can find inspiration in a bumper sticker, or the bumper sticker has
happiness
to be
is a choice. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. So I wanted to just clarify scientific or broadly. I would say broadly, I'm most inspired by more philosophical books, very carefully written and deeply written philosophical books. And I would say one of those is a book by Francis Bacon, who many people think started the modern scientific project, certainly was the intellectual founder of the Royal Society, which a couple of years ago celebrated its 350th anniversary.
Right, Atlantis.
Yeah, The New Atlantis. The New Atlantis is the book.
I saw your lecture on Francis Bacon on YouTube today.
Oh, you did? Okay, yeah. Well, that was on The New Atlantis. So
yes,
perfectly.
New Atlantis research lecture.
Good. Well, I hope it was inspiring.
So, and do you have any passions or hobbies you explore during evenings and weekends?
I guess my main passion, I wouldn't quite call it a hobby, but is exploring these philosophical works, trying to understand these thinkers, and trying to understand what they can teach us about how to live, also about how we can be better. They have probably a greater understanding than anyone else.
Right.
And I wouldn't, certainly not a hobby, because it's something that takes a lot of time and effort, but it is something that's actually reflected in a project that I have, an undergraduate educational project here at MIT that focuses around ethics, but it's ethics in terms of understanding different ethical approaches from these great thinkers.
So do you read Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, Spinoza?
Well, absolutely, I've read those. Spinoza is a great passion.
He's very deep, but he's really good.
He's very good. We don't read those particularly in our classes here at MIT.
Okay.
But Cicero, for example, Cicero either here,
yeah.
But we read Aristotle.
Oh, of course.
Sometimes
of
Plato,
course.
Certainly yeah. Francis Bacon.
Oh.
Benjamin Franklin is a great writer. I recommend if anyone's not read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
It's excellent.
That book can teach you so many things, not just about the life, but how to write. You can just copy the book 10 times and you can be a better writer.
Oh, absolutely. And he was inspired by Bacon.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. What is your preferential way for someone to get in touch with you? If someone who is listening to us and wants to get in touch with you with a proposal or a question about what we talked about, what's your preferential way to email, Twitter?
Well, if the proposal encompasses a check, just mail it. But yeah, no, I think email is the best way.
Email. And just, your email address can be found on MIT website.
That's the nice thing about academics.
You can't hide.
Easy to find. We can't hide. It's
you
just
can't hide.
trout@mit.edu.
Do you have any ask or request for our audience? Any parting words before we say goodbye?
No, I guess I would say in terms of continuous manufacturing, I think that's the future of pharmaceutical manufacturing. We can incorporate the kind of questions you ask about developability and manufacturability. So I guess if you asked about an ask, my ask would be, we have as human beings a tendency against change. In a certain sense, we adopt change, but that's really after it's already been.
There are no other options.
Is that, well, there are no other options or after everyone else is adopting it.
Right.
And so
people with rotary phones. They only bought cordless phones because they stopped making rotary phones.
Right. Well, but that's it. But social media, these kind of things that we adopt, email, I mean, I'm sure it was a bit slow. I started adopting it as an undergraduate here in our internal system at MIT in the 80s. But I think my ask is we ought to, first of all, recognize our natural tendency to resist adopting change and to think about that, based on that understanding, to be more open to incorporating continuous manufacturing ideas, quality ideas, developability, manufacturability. Resist your resistance towards these things.
that's great. Professor Trout, thank you very much for your time, and thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for the invitation.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to subscribe and let others know. Word of mouth is our oxygen. Visit www.ispeboston.org for the comprehensive show notes from today's episode and also find out more ways to associate with us. Do let us know your thoughts in the comment section, and if there is someone you'd like to see as a guest on this show, thanks again for joining us today. We'll see you next time.